Welcome everyone to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are in paper 51, section 6, which is old single column, page 586. All right, before we get into these last two sections in this paper here, let me just do a little footnote, a little aside, that we didn't have time to touch upon last session. Just a little issue about changes to the text that have occurred for many reasons over the years. If you look back in that previous section, that next to the last paragraph of section 5, see that last sentence, how it starts out? Now, yours may say "on your world," or it may say "in your world." And I just wanted to touch on that. So the original is "in your world," okay? Recently there's that's been modified to the more prosaic "on your world." Basically because there's no other place in the book where it says "in your world." It all, like if you look in the like the next to the last sentence of the last paragraph there, you can see "on your world," right? You can see it being used "on your world" right there.
Which section are you in?
Section 5, okay. The end of section 5. One of the things that gets argued a lot lately is, we should make everything in the book consistent. You know, if there's something that seems to stick out, you should make it the same as every other instance that seems it's kind of like that. Now, obviously, it's not a huge issue in this case, but to argue that "in your world" doesn't make any sense is nonsensical. Of course, it makes sense. Right? There's no reason to change it, especially just because it's the only time it occurs. God the Mother only occurs one time in the book. Should we change that because it only occurs one time? Maybe it should have said "God the Father," right? You could argue, right? Or "God the Almighty" only occurs one time in the book. Should we change that? Maybe it should have said "God the Supreme." I mean, you can rationalize anything, right? Just because something occurs only once, there's no reason to think that there's a typo, okay? The word "world," okay, in terms of its literal meaning, it literally means mankind, etymologically. The "were" part there is like the "were" in werewolf. It's man, right? The basic reason, say that the revelators will use the word "world" rather than "planet," is if they want to stress that it's a planet that's inhabited. Because the word "world," see, fundamentally implies habitation. Right? Right, and so, it actually is a little bit redundant to say "inhabited worlds." Right? Like we are, this block of papers that we're studying right now, right, has that group name. We all know that we use the word "world" in that to indicate something besides just the mere fact of a planet. And even in a more abstract way, like say the scientific world, you'll say, or something like that, right? Or the art world, you'll use the word "world" like that, as a sphere of some concept or fact or a domain of something. I mean, you can see, right, if you just reflect on the paragraph, you know, look at what they're doing in that paragraph. They, if you look up at the second sentence there in that next to the last paragraph, starts out following, right, following this procreative outpouring. You know, we're talking about the biologic uplift here, remember? Following this procreative outpouring of imported ability and super evolutionary traits, there ensues a succession of rapid strides in civilization and racial development. Okay? That's the point of this paragraph, that you're thinking about what's going on, quote, in civilization and racial development. Okay? And they follow up in that last sentence in the paragraph on the, picking up that again. Right? In your world is shorthand for in your civilization and racial development. Right? Just a way of saying the same thing, only short, not, you know, being pedantic and repeating the whole thing. Right? They're talking about in that sphere of civilization and racial development. Right, as that last sentence goes, great progress has been made, right? Even in the face of the miscarriage. Right? So, I mean, it makes complete sense. Right? You don't have to flatten the three-dimensionality of that sentence and say on. Right?
But it sounds better.
Right? Yeah. And just, you know, appreciate that, you know, kind of the point is to not just be speaking, you know, like in that last paragraph where it says, you know, such an unwise procedure would jeopardize all civilization on your world. Okay? There is just, you know, the matter-of-fact thing. There's, you know, they're talking about your civilization on your world. Okay, yeah, you say on your world. You're just indicating the place, right, where that civilization is. But, you know, in this case, you're not just indicating a place like that. You're trying to think about getting in a certain context, right? In the context of civilization and racial development, like they said at the beginning, right? It doesn't say, you know, the rapid strides on civilization and racial development. You know, well, of course it doesn't. That doesn't make any sense. Well, right? It's parallel. It's in your world. They're just repeating that. In your civilization and racial development, you know, great progress has been made. And so, you know, people need to reflect more. You know, they have to stop thinking so mechanically about the revelation. You know, in this instance, okay, it's not a huge issue. Right? Other times you change one two-letter word like that, and it goes from revelation to abomination, right? And that's been done in a few places, right? You can't just change a two-letter preposition randomly, right? If you're ignorant of what the truth is flowing through it, right? It literally turns it into a restatement of the Lucifer Manifesto when you change that preposition.
Have you talked to him about
it? Good luck. We're not going to talk about any sort of... Anyway, you know, remember, this is courageous and independent cosmic thinking we're developing here. We're not trying to create a group think. I'm trying to encourage you. You have to have an integrity that transcends anyone who would argue for changes in the revelation, right?
But if mine says on, I would have never known it says in.
Right.
Mine happens to say in.
Right.
Yeah. So I never know yours says on.
All the new ones say on, right? You know, it says on now.
That's merit.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right. But just, you know, we don't need to talk about the details of it.
I'm not trying to go there. Yeah. I'm just wanting to have an outreach to them that,
again,
can you
they're
think
not
about
going
this?
Right. No, they're not going there.
And if you
because,
haven't even tried, then okay. It's not
and the reason that you don't want to go there is you can rationalize anything, right? You can't argue with a rationalization scheme. You know, none of these things are made arbitrarily by the people who make these changes. They have elaborate reasons, you know, in detail, right?
Yeah.
Right. It's, you know, it's just a simple opportunity for you to do what you have to do all the time. You know, just to make it poignant to the, you know, the time, the time we're in here right now in culture, you know, it's election season, right? I mean, I've mentioned this a few times. I mean, anything that can remind you that you need to stand independently of people's verbiage, right? Because you can rationalize anything.
So how do you know that this wasn't a typo when they said you, it because we don't have the original?
You don't know it wasn't a typo.
Okay.
But you can notice there's no reason to change it from the original because it makes perfect sense.
Either way.
They're right? Just fashion your Ranger book in their image.
Right. I mean, if you change an obvious typo, okay, but to imagine typos, right, is another matter. Okay. But just like I said, independent of the Ranger book itself, you know, in this particular change, just in general. You know, you want to be cultivating an integrity where, no matter how clever someone's argument is, no matter how sound, how airtight someone's, you know, rationalization of something seems to be, can you stand independent of that? Can you think objectively in the face of a very clever argument, or not?
Isn't that just a second
adjective? Right. Do you have a logical acumen that can stand apart from the second adjutant, okay? Especially the second adjutant in the hands of a very intelligent person, you know, who can put forward very enticing dots of the facts. You both agree on the facts, and then that clever person says, and here's how you connect dots through those facts. And you're going, well, yeah, you're smarter than me, and that does seem to make sense. Okay, yeah, okay, yes, it's rational, but is it logical? Can you assess it independent of rational? This isn't the greatest example for that per se, but I did point out to you. I mean, you can just look in the context. It's like, well, is it contextual? Yes, it is. I mean. In, right? Simple logical consistency, things like that, rather than just mechanical consistency. Well, I searched the book for the expression in your world, and I don't see it anywhere else, so it's obviously a typo. Okay, that's just not a valid argument for changing something. Okay? You know, and along those lines, another reason why you don't want to make little changes, even if they seem to be incidental, like maybe they're just a spelling change or something like that. The reason that a proper name might be spelled differently in one spot of the book, you know, in two different spots in the book, is because it's tied to two different human source works. Right? And that particular spelling actually, you know, helps you to link it to a human source work if you want to, you know, get into that depth of you know, engaging the parallel between the two. All right, so if you sanitize it, right, you know, you are breaking all those links. Right? Subtle issues like that. Right? It's not a sacred text with typos. It's an organic phenomenon that's tied to the evolutionary process. Right? And you got to think like that. All right. You can see why someone is reading. Oh, wait a minute, that must be a typo. I mean, in, what does that mean? You know, we're not inside of the earth, we're on it, right? Well, yeah, if you think really simplistically like that, it appears to be a typo. See? But can you go beyond the appearance? Can you penetrate through that appearance and say, well, okay, it appears to be a typo, but is it really? Well, let me see. Well, it might not be. I can certainly see how it could not be a typo. It makes complete sense. Why not leave it, right? That sort of greater humility should be in play. All right. Now back to regularly scheduled programming. you can see how I did want to open that can of worms when we were already kind of running over a bit last time. Taken us way over time. But all right, so these last two sections in this paper begin a transition to the next paper. Now, if you look forward, you know, you'll see that the next paper is Planetary Mortal Epochs, where we, you know, get into a lot greater detail on that, the whole sequence of dispensations on a world. And they're segueing into that greater discussion in these last two sections, especially the very last section of this paper, you see, is sort of summing up this paper and the previous paper, the paper about the planetary princes and this one about the planetary atoms, right? And, you know, thinking about them in that sequence of the dispensations and how those two dispensations begin to come together as you go forward in time. All right, so that's the main point here is to kind of get us spun up to really engage that next topic in detail in the next paper. So let's just jump in here. So you've got this little bit about the more directly about Adam and Eve, but you'll see that they're bringing in the context of the planetary prince in this section.
6. The Edenic regime. On most of the inhabited worlds, the Garden of Eden remain as superb cultural centers and continue to function as the social patterns of planetary conduct and usage age after age. Even in early times, when the violet peoples are relatively segregated, their schools receive suitable candidates from among the world races, while the industrial developments of the garden open up new channels of commercial intercourse. Thus do the Adam and Eves and their progeny contribute to the sudden expansion of culture and to the rapid improvement of evolutionary races on their world, of their worlds. And all of these relationships are augmented and sealed by the amalgamation of the evolutionary race and the sons of Adam.
Races
and the sons of Adam, resulting in the immediate upstepping of biological status, the quickening of intellectual potential, and the enhancement of spiritual receptivity.
Okay, that first part we're going to get into a little bit more just immediately next here. That bit about on most inhabited worlds, how the gardens of Eden remain. We'll talk about that a little bit more in a minute here. But we'll talk a little bit more about exactly the specifics of the schools here as we go forward too. So let's just kind of table both of those for the moment. But, you know, you do notice that they're, you know, they're reminding you of that whole bit about receiving suitable candidates, right? So how they're bringing them in and sending them out, like we've talked about. You know, they're really going to start to, Adam and Eve start to really get the interaction between the races going much more significantly than the planetary prince and his staff try to do. If for no other reason, I mean, right, I mean, eventually you want to blend them into one race, so you got to get them interacting. So there's that. And then, you know, obviously, this is a suddenly sort of a thing, right? You've got this fiat injection into the evolutionary stream that in some ways is more intrusive even than the planetary prince and his staff. Right? I mean, you're literally going to be mating with the evolutionary stock here. You know, so it's a very definitive, suddenly sort of a thing, like this sudden expansion of culture and rapid improvement of the evolutionary races. And like they're saying, you know, it's you know, you obviously you have some of that just by the cultural influence of them and their teachings, and they're encouraging them interacting more and even starting to intermate, you know, some. Getting some super additive consequence going. But in terms of it, like you say, augmented and sealed, right, that's obviously by them, the violet race, directly mating into the evolutionary races. And then you're really going to get the booster shot and you're going to lock it down solid genetically. All of the squishiness of the evolutionary genetics is going to be eliminated by that biologic uplift. It's going to become a very robust stock, right, that can resist all kinds of viral and bacterial assault, and right, it's a much more integrous race that goes forward from Adam and Eve's efforts. And then that last bit, let's just remind ourselves again, because we were stressing this before, remember, it's not just the immediacy of upstepping the biologic status, like they say there, but you got the quickening of intellectual potential, right? Because you're not just improving the genetics overall that adjutant mind is attuned to, but that modified genetics introduces a bias, you would say, that comes into symmetry with the other biases for the other adjutants, right? A bias towards the seventh adjutant, right? In the Sangic stocks, you've got the seventh adjutant, but no one is giving it much favor, right? It's kind of an afterthought for all six of them, right? So you boost that, you know, so that the seventh adjutant isn't an afterthought, right? It's on par, just kind of energetically, and then it begins to take over the governorship of the other six adjutants, right? So you have this quickening of intellectual potential, because the seventh, you not only have another adjutant kind of more in play, but you have it starting to really get more super additive consequence going between the other six adjutants, right? So the quickening, right, of intellectual potential. And the seventh adjutant doesn't just work downward to the other six, it opens you up more definitively. When you increase that relationship to the seventh, it opens you up more definitively to the Holy Spirit encirclement, the three cosmic intuitions, and anything else that you might get, like the Spirit of Truth or thought adjusters. Okay. So hence that enhancement of spiritual receptivity. Right? With, if you have just a tiny little swizzle stick of conduit that's your relationship to the seventh adjutant, you can't you can have all kinds of engagement by spirit, but there's no way to feed it down into the mind, right? Until you open up the gates a bit by improving that relationship to the seventh adjutant. So, spirit ministries are speaking, but there's no receivers, right? So that enhancement of spiritual receptivity. Right? So you get the whole package, right? From bottom to top, the matter, mind, and relationship to spirit is all being improved here. So that you've got, you no longer have any kind of blind spots in the whole system, right? You can really have a full systemic phenomenon now, where matter, mind, and spirit have minimal blockages to really start to work together as a triunity, right? That's the whole point, right? You're not trying to get you're not trying to become some sort of a purely spirit phenomenon, in contrast to starting as quote-unquote some purely material phenomenon. Now, the whole point is to get a triunity, to have individuality, associativity, and unity together in a triunity. And it just is not possible until you get this booster relationship to the seventh adjutant. That's the means for coordinating the whole phenomenon. That's why, when you look on the threefold actuality with unity chart, you look at that additional label I gave for the seventh adjutant there down in the bottom block, right? And it's not just the spirit of wisdom. You can also think of it as the energy of symmetry, right? It's the fundamental mindal energy phenomenon that when it functions, it's that means for getting a symmetry going in the whole system. It's through it that happens. Okay.
And this is all activated biologically.
Right.
And it's kind of fascinating.
Right, and it's all done, by just improving what you're attuning to. Right?
And that's a biological improvement.
Yeah.
It's not a mind or one.
It's a biologic improvement, which produces a mindful improvement, which produces a spiritual improvement. And, you know, it works up the stack. You know.
Just out of curiosity, is it achievable if you really work at it, or do you have to have the biological achievement? Is there? You know what I'm asking? Because we're kind of like.
Right, because
we're kind of in a tough situation here.
Right, because we didn't get that biologic uplift like we should have. There's no way until we have the wisdom to start, you know, genetically re-engineering us. But right now, there's no way to, you know, to get that sort of natural bottom-up improvement like this that we're describing. You know, so you need to exercise your free will more than normal. You know, you can, you know, sort of jump up, if you will, and work your way down as best you can. Now, there's no way to start at the top and go all the way down to the bottom and have mind reorganize your genetics and turn it into Adamicogenic genetics. But you can get up there and start using spirit over mind, because that, you know, isn't so limited by the matter. Like I just said, mind over matter is going to have some limits because of the, you know, material limits. Okay? But you can definitely work on and not having your mind sequence just totally dictated by what the genetics wants it to be, right?
The master had our genetics, and yet he did
something. Right. See, there's a great case in point. I mean, he didn't, you know, they didn't give him, special genetics. You know, they didn't go in there and tweak, you know, the genetics that he got from Joseph and Mary. I mean, obviously Gabriel made sure that they were. You know, it was a reasonable starting point, so there wasn't a fundamental limitation. But one of the things that he demonstrates for us is that despite those genetic limitations on this world, you can go all the way to first circular. Now, you can't go, you won't be as profound a first circular as someone on a very, you know, normal world, with all the uplift and everything, but there isn't a fundamental limitation. You know, if you take delight in cultivating, you know, getting up, starting at the top, taking delight in cultivating, developing the insights into the cosmos through the three cosmic intuitions, getting that connection to the cosmos established, so that the harmony of the cosmos can begin to feed down into your mind. Until you supply the favorable conditions, doesn't matter how juxtaposed you are to the harmony of the cosmos, it's not being fed down in. You've got to supply the favorable conditions, and it'll start to feed in, and you'll get harmony in the upper domains of your mind, just like Jesus achieved. Right? In spite of the fact that down at the bottom, even in his mind, there was still all of the cross currents and stuff from the, you know, genetic mishmash. Peoples in the Near East are, you know, like we mentioned before, are mongrels, or, you know, they're racially, you know, a hodgepodge. That's why the revelators say it's sad to record that so few persons take delight in cultivating. Right? I mean, yes, you've got a lot of genetic limitations, and, you know, and you don't have a Adam and Eve and a planetary prince and all this sort of stuff, but there's so much you could do, especially when you have catalyzers for this process of bringing the harmony down. I mean, you have both the thought adjuster, everyone does, and the spirit of truth, which improve the efficiency of bringing that harmony down into your mind. Right? I mean, if you would just supply some favorable conditions, right? Because you have those two additional things universally, I mean, you'll get 10 times more than the normal person would when all they have is the Holy Spirit. Right, and they're still trying to get up to third circular and get an adjuster and that sort of stuff. Right, I mean, the fact that you've got those catalyzing influences of the spirit of truth and the thought adjuster, there's no reason why you can't achieve a relatively high level of intellectual development. right, in conformity with the cosmos. Okay? All right. I say, then we got everything. Yeah, let's keep going here.
On normal worlds, the garden headquarters of the Vile race becomes the second center of world culture, and jointly with the headquarters city of the planetary prince, sets the pace for the development of civilization. For centuries, the city headquarters schools of the planetary prince and the garden schools of Adam and Eve are contemporary. They are usually not very far apart, and they work together in harmonious cooperation.
Okay, so just, you know, the little tidbit there, you know, you might wonder, it's like, well, they weren't very far apart on this planet. I wonder if that's common. You know, it's for them to just tell you that is the normal thing, that you don't stick them on opposite sides of the globe or something, right? You know, or, you know, one of them, you know, very hard to get to because, you know, one of them's on an island, sort of a continent or something. I mean, you're going to want them to be, you know, relatively accessible, you know, together. All right, so that's a common thing that they do. And like I said, they're going to explain a little bit more about the differential between the schools in the two places as we go forward. But you can tell initially, you know, it's not like when Adam and Eve come, they just melt into what the planetary prince is doing, or vice versa, right? Initially, they stand with a degree of separateness so that you can have that differential and you can have that super additive potential, you know, interplay between the two, okay? So note that, you know, that, the, you know, despite what you might initially suspect, it, you know, they aren't just immediately brought together. They're allowed to evolve together. That's a good little point of fact to keep in mind that about, we were just talking about how there's this distinct suddenly to the planetary prince or Adam and Eve arriving, right? But, you know, remember that they know what's too much suddenly, you know, too much artificial suddenly, you know, a big natural suddenly, okay, that's fine, right? But this is obviously an artificial suddenly, they're only going to be as kind of disruptive as they have to be, right? You're always biasing towards the evolution of the Supreme. No one in the universe of universes, including the Ancients of Days or anyone else, you know, is endlessly presumptive about the evolutionary process, right? You know that if someone has any doubt about whether or not they should do, you know, intervene in something or not, they don't. Right? If it isn't definitively clear that this coordinates with the whole of the Supreme and everything, they're not going to intervene. They're going to let it play out. You know, everyone fundamentally trusts the evolutionary process. And I'm stressing that just kind of to build you up to, again, to recognize why this book is in my lap. Another reason why this book is in my lap. Humans do not have that humility. We are becoming more and more hopeless with each year, you know, let alone decade.
But they don't know, thinking
that we should short circuit the evolutionary process by fiat. You know, we shouldn't just let, you know, the states of, you know, evolve through processes. You know, we see the end from the beginning, and we should just institute in a blanket fashion some sort of evolutionary improvement, you know, quote unquote, some improvement. It's like, no, none of us can improve upon the evolutionary process, right? The mind of the Supreme is a little bigger than any of ours, sees a little bigger picture than any of us do, right? And we need to remind ourselves of that. It's not that we shouldn't act, but we need to be more humble about this. We're becoming insane about it, you know? We're getting down into all kinds of minutiae, you know, and instituting things by grand fiat now. And if we keep that up, we will break the country, right? There's no way we'll hold ourselves together if we continue along this line. That's what the Revelation, one of the reasons the Revelation is here, because we're starting to do that too much. We aren't humble enough, right? One of those favorable conditions to be grown is humility, right?
How do you inculcate that, though, into the mindset of the vast majority of people that you don't?
I mean, you're not, again...
I know we're not going to.
Right. And again, I mean, it's not our job to inculcate that, you know, universally. I mean, especially since this is not a dispensational revelation.
Right.
So it's not meant to be spread universally, right? You know, you start with yourself. Yeah, and if you finish with yourself, okay, now think about something else. I mean, it's, you know, kind of the rule of thumb. You start with self-mastery. You know, you start with yourself, no longer being a voice that's parroting the ignorance of the collective, right? Stop nodding your head up and down. You know, when everyone says, well, obviously we should do such and so, right? Can you step back and say, no, yeah, we could do that. And I can see how that, you know, is tied to a recognition of transcendent ideals. But what about time? What about the evolutionary process? Do I really know if now is the time for that change? Change without growth is potential evil. Right? Right? I mean, to have that sink in, that a correct change done at the wrong time is evil. Right? You can't just think about it existentially. You know what I'm saying? Well, existentially it's good, therefore it's good at any time. No. It's fundamentally good only at one time and no other time. Any other time, it's evil. But do you know which time that is? Do you at least try to figure that out? Or do you just do like everyone does? Do you assume... Well, existentially, it's good. Therefore, you can do it now. No. You've got to synchronize with the growth of the Supreme. You can't change things that are out of sync with the growth of the Supreme. Changes out of sync with the Supreme are evil changes, not good changes. It doesn't matter if existentially they're good. Evolutionarily, they're not good. You can't just synchronize them with perfectness. You have to synchronize them with perfecting this.
Mm-hmm. Talk about the collective and how we coordinate with that Supreme. Each one of us plays a part, correct?
Right. I mean, and you know, there's no way that we can consciously synchronize ourselves with the whole. So how does this happen? How do we get this big picture integrity so that maybe some of our actions... won't be, you know, at best erroneous and, you know, or worse. The physics of that is done for you. If you just take delight in cultivating, if you do the things that you do understand, you understand the physics of humility. You understand the physics, you know, of being just. You understand the physics of being sincere, right? Leave the physics of the synchronization to the universal harmony to the creative mother spirit. Right? She will synchronize you. If you supply the favorable conditions that you understand the physics of, she'll take care of the physics that you don't understand. Now, how it is that you actually rearrange the forms in your mind so that they can form to the universal harmony, right? Let alone what the universal harmony even is that you're trying to conform to. Right? We don't need to know that.
What I'm asking is if what is your impact on the collective?
Right. Okay, so that was my impact on the collective is if I achieve some synchronization with the universal harmony, I can be a conduit for that to spread into the collective.
Via the mother?
Right. I mean, she's always, you know, the one that's the engine behind it. Right? Mother Deity is always the engine behind it. I have to supply the favorable conditions in order to be used in a productive way like that. So you can see how important humility is, I mean, to this whole process. Since I don't understand what needs to be done, I don't understand how it's going to be done, right? But if I supply the favorable conditions, I may be the means that something gets done. But just because I want to be the means, no. Right? No amount of consecration of my will gets me there. I have to get my mind consecrated to the universal harmony. That, because that's the way for the collective to benefit from my individuality.
And you should never underestimate it.
Never underestimate, you know. I mean, occasionally there's a seminal individual, you know, who's in the right place at the right time when it's time for a change, you know, and that change fundamentally happens through that one individual. But that's not because that individual squinted really hard and willed it into existence, right? The favorable conditions were there, you know, and they were a means to an end. It's not about them. That's the fundamental thing. And you know, we need to take all tension of time about it. It's like, well, things are really bad. Someone's got to do something. No. I mean, the moment that you get impatient like that, you know you're never going to be any benefit to the collective. Ask Adam and Eve. You know, how benefiting to the collective they were when they were the tiniest bit impatient. One little minuscule drop of impatience and right? Yep, Gene.
One way I thought about it is what will be upheld? If I do something that is in harmony with the cosmos, no matter how small, that will be upheld.
Yeah.
But if I go out into the world and make the biggest, most rambunctious change I possibly can, if it's not in conformity with the cosmos, it will just...
Yeah, it'll just melt away.
No good will ever come up.
Yeah, for those of you in the webinar, if you couldn't catch that, he's making a great point about, you know, if you think about, you know, the changes that you could possibly make that are appropriate are those that are upheld going forward. We humans don't uphold anything, no matter how much it might appear we do. You know, and a lot of people... become poster children for that fact. You know, they're very industrious, very brilliant, very prolific. I mean, and they construct a magnificent edifice about their life. You know, that is a glory to all those around them, and everyone, you know, is benefiting from this, and it's a great delight to mankind. But the moment they die, poof, it evaporates. Right. Well, it was having such positive effect. Yeah, but you see, it wasn't synchronized with the Supreme. It would have been upheld. It would have been ongoing if it had been. It was an illusion. You know, and most likely, there will be a bunch of negative things that will result from it down the road. You know, because you did things ahead of their time a little bit. You know, it may not be huge, it might be gigantic, you never know. I mean, the mustard seed thing is hard to predict, right? So, you know, it requires, you know, a lot of recognition that, you know, that you're trying, the more you can kind of get a sense of what's being upheld right now, the more you can try to, well, let me work on fostering what obviously is in the upholding stream here. You know, something I can tell that transcends just the will of a single individual, you know, to impose himself upon the environment, right, for a brief flash of time.
Yeah. What is it that nothing of value is ever lost? Is it stored in the Supreme somewhere?
Well, and that bit about, you know, it's very important to remember the one word that everyone forgets about in that line. It doesn't say nothing of value is ever lost. It says nothing of survival value is ever lost, right? Things that, you know, are value that is not individuated, that is, you know, not separated from the collective value of this that is the supreme, you know, it appears to be in the hands of an individual, and then we see it being lost. You were just describing that. It can be the case that value is lost, you know, because when you judge value as this individuation of value melts away and is gone after that person dies, and appears, right, that value is lost. Right, but see, it wasn't really survival by, because it wasn't definitively individuated. You know, that phenomenon was just a lump in the supreme, as it were. You know, a thick spot in the. So you know, it's important to remember that bit about you know, if something is going to endure via your individuality, it has to not just be value. It has to be quote unquote survival value. You have to have individuated it. Relative to the supreme, and that's what I was another way of thinking about what I was just describing. Right, those things that have that you know, individuated sort of value will be ongoing, will be enduring. Right, other things are just drops of water in the ocean. See, and they melt away. Right? You know, think about how we judge that value word. I mean, none of us. You know, can step back and see the whole of the supreme and assess value on that scale, right? Our assessment of value is very relative. We have this very, you know, small little circumscribed field of view that we're observing, you know, and we see value in that little thing, and then it melts away. And you go, wait a minute, I thought nothing of value was ever lost. It's like, no, that's not what it says. Okay. Let's see, meanwhile, back to this. Let's see. Okay, so yeah, they're not far apart, and they're working on that harmonious cooperation, right? So they're working on, this is kind of picks up right what we were just talking about. The two camps stay separate, but they're working on getting that duality into synchrony with the universal harmony. Okay? That's what they're trying to do. There's a certain way that the two centers need to work together that's specific to this planet and the relationship of the Supreme to this planet, and they've got to figure that out experientially. They don't know the end from the beginning. They don't come here, you know, do X, Y, and Z and everything. You know, they've got to kind of go with the flow of the planet, get themselves synchronized with it. And so over a long process, they figure out how to kind of come into harmony with the presence of supremacy on this world. Okay, and then what do they say here?
Think what it would mean on your world if somewhere in the Levant there were a world center of civilization, a great planetary university of culture, which had functioned uninterruptedly for 37,000 years. And again, pause to consider how the moral authority of even such an ancient center would be reinforced were there situated not far distant still another and older headquarters of celestial ministry whose traditions would exert a cumulative force of 500,000 years of integrated evolutionary influence. It is custom which eventually spreads the ideals of Eden to a whole world.
Fascinating little footnote. Let's do that last little sentence first, because it fits into what we were just talking about. See again how they're pointing to, you know, it's the evolutionary process that really disseminates this, right? They're very minimal. They only inject themselves and micromanage the minimum amount, and then they let everything else just play out in the process. They don't, you know, go out in a mighty force of evangelistic power, right, and spread it to the four corners of the earth. They let it just diffuse, you know, through the evolutionary process, you know, and it just, you know, it begins to become a custom, because the people become accustomed to it, right? And it slowly takes root and spreads. See, think about the wisdom of that. That's what I was just saying. No one with spiritual consciousness is doing that on this planet. No one has that kind of patience and humility. Everyone is trying to just fiat change the planet overnight, you know, or their country overnight. We're going to just institute this regulation or this law, and now we've got life, light and life. You know, no one, even someone as intrusive as a planetary prince or an Adam and Eve, don't work that way. They're not that stupid. They're not that ignorant. They're wise. They trust the evolutionary process. We've got to start doing that because we're breaking our civilization, right, by trying to fiat it to light and life. That's what Lucifer wanted to do, fiat the local system to light and life. He didn't want the evolutionary process. It took too much time. It was too foolish, right? Too many curly cues and whatnot to it. You know, it's like, let's just do it efficiently. Let's go from just point A to point Z. Skip all the letters in between.
You know, when you talk about how the least intrusive means of affecting an evolutionary change that Adam and Eve were supposed to use in the time it takes to synchronize or find out how to synchronize with the Supreme, it really underscores how impatient they were.
Yeah, right. I mean, the impatience differential that they manifested, their task is designed for a 25,000-year rollout.
Right.
I mean, pretty much universally, every Adam and Eve. That their task is spread out over 25,000 years. Our Adam and Eve gave up after 100 years. 100 years. A little smaller than 25,000. I mean, you know, it's so insanely impatient, right? You know, and again, it's like, well, this place is different. You know, don't we need to modify things? You know, we can't just trust that the Supreme can deal with this set of facts. No, the Supreme can deal with any set of facts. The Supreme Mind can transcends all finite facts. It can adapt to any set of finite facts. No set of finite facts are too extreme for it.
Right? And remember, their whole thing was, well, we can't be doing wrong if we really
believe
we're doing right.
Right. Not to mention, yeah, that humility bordering on lack of humility bordering on self-righteousness. Yes, you know, that pride that goeth before a fall. You know, it appears right to me, therefore it must be right. Huh? You know, who are you? Right, there's so little humility there. Okay, so that just, you know, you see that again, just how they're just kind of gently putting that in, but in each of these paragraphs, but I'm stressing this because this is the mountain that's, or the molehill that's turned into a mountain, you know, in modern times here, so-called modern times. This lack of patience and humility and just allowing the evolutionary process time to play. And, you know, yes, those people still have primitive mores, but it's not your job to choose for them. Right? Things will go a lot better if you stop making personal plans for other personalities, right? We've got to have some humility again. You got to let it play out.
So we have anything even close to the thousands of years that you look at?
Graduations,
yes. No, I meant on the planet. Many cultural centers is very. You know, much less one 500,000 years or 37. We don't even have one.
Right.
You only make personal plans for your husband.
Yeah. I mean, you know, how long did the Roman Empire last? You know, relatively not that long, you know. To get to the other points there, about 37,000 years and 500,000 years. Yeah, I mean, you think about the stability that a line laid out that long would provide on the planet, you know? I mean, just, you know, how immovable, you know, such a line would be. Now, the interesting thing, of course, you know, that's kind of between the lines there is our world is a little different than the run of the mill, right? If Adam and Eve hadn't defaulted, would the garden on the peninsula be there? No, Remember, it was designed to just be there for a few thousand years. Yeah, and so this whole bit about that we're about to get into a little bit more beginning to modify how the two centers function or beginning to merge them together. See, there was kind of some different plans on our planet. The two kind of really, world center, sort of dual world center thing was not supposed to be on this planet. That first garden was supposed to just be there for a few thousand years until they built up, basically a 500,000 people. And then they were supposed to go out and establish regional centers and stuff. And maybe the plan, they don't tell us, maybe some of the plans was to kind of, have Adam and Eve be sort of co-located with some sort of a more planetary headquarters-like thing. Of course, we didn't have the planetary princess headquarters for them to meld into, but, maybe the idea was to kind of reinvigorate that.
One of the plans was to send 1 million people to the retina.
Right, you're right. There's those additional issues.
They had some things.
We do know about some of those details like that. But just when this whole bit of uninterruptedly for 37,000 years, yes and no. Not in a simplistic way. The first garden would have been interrupted even if they hadn't defaulted. Okay, but that cultural influence would be uninterrupted for 37,000 years.
Maybe there's 37 instead of 38 or 39. Isn't it closer to 39?
It's actually they're kind of lobbing off a few hundred years there.
2000,
is it? No, it's a little over 37,000. Okay. Not quite 38,000. They're lobbing off that, rounding it, because obviously there's a kind of the initial little process, and then once things are settled in, then they're starting the clock going. But when it's still in its formation phase, it's not a uniform thing where you can think of it being uninterrupted, right? So they're kind of giving you the settle down time, and once it's settled in, right, there would have been 37,000 years.
History, origin, destiny thing they talk about from time to time. That
origin, history, destiny.
You got my gist. we don't, as you say, most people don't even, first of all, they don't have a clue about what it is, and they don't think about it much. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's really, people don't really, I don't think even anybody who really thinks a lot, it thinks that whole picture out a little bit, the whole picture of who we are, why we're here, that kind of thing, from that point of view. It's a tricky one.
That's why, even on the homepage of Perfecting Horizons Institute, the blurb for the public discussion group here, the Friday night group, I emphasize that fact, we're trying to, in all different areas of our thought, to get that origin, history, destiny, big picture perspective in play. That's one of the things we're trying to do here, fundamentally, to not be caught up in the rationalizations of the moment, like everyone else on the planet is, the so-called conventional wisdom, right, of the moment, and to begin to stand apart from that and see things in this bigger context, so that you can begin to live a life loyal to that bigger context. And if you want to make an impact on someone else, what do they tell you? Remember the tadpole passage, right? Live loyally as a tadpole, right? I mean, the way you'll potentially make an impression upon someone else is a demonstration of a loyalty to something transcendent of what they're loyal to, right? Don't try to, teach them something verbally or pictorially or whatnot. I mean, not precept or even example, right? Just live your life loyal to a bigger picture, right? So that you manifest a peace that transcends the kind of peace you can have with the tiny little, cork that they're bobbing on. Get yourself on a great big huge beam, in the ocean. And, live relative to that the stability of that big beam, right? And they will notice that. That's the way you'll make a difference in someone else's life, is living loyalty to something transcendent of what they're living loyal to. And you don't have to tell them that, right? Either they have the ability to notice that or not, right? And if they don't, nothing you say or do will help. And if they do, you don't have to say anything. Right? It speaks for itself. So just, you know, that's the favorable condition thing, you know, simple favorable condition thing you can do to make an impact beyond the end of your nose. Is living loyalty to supreme values. Okay. All right. So, like I was saying, it's kind of an interesting to think about how we would have had an ongoing phenomenon with a lot more complexity here than on a normal world. But nonetheless, you know, even though the facts would be slightly different, the truth of what they're saying there would hold here. Now they get to this a little bit more about the schools.
The schools of the planetary prince are primarily concerned with philosophy, religion, morals, and the higher intellectual and artistic achievements. The garden schools of Adam and Eve are usually devoted to practical arts, fundamental intellectual training, social culture, economic development, trade relations, physical efficiency, and civil government. Eventually, these world centers amalgamate, but this actual affiliation sometimes does not occur until the times of the first magisterial son.
See how they're starting to transition into the next paper. See right there. Notice the basic thing. The things that are tied to the garden schools, see, are much more fundamentally material issues, right? Because that's their role. They're there to get the material comfort era in play, right? I mean, they're the biologic uplifters. They're where the rubber meets the road, literally, right? I mean, so all the things they're doing are those very practical, you know, immediate, related to the physical existence sort of stuff. And the higher things are done at the prince's school. You know, and notice what's first in the list there, philosophy. All right. Obviously you can't start with that, but that's the goal you're heading towards. But you can see kind of just if you think about the basic three, you've got philosophy and religion in the prince's school and science in the garden school.
But the prince's staff, they're not attempting to teach philosophy when they first come here.
Right, okay, so yeah, good point. Right, so when they first come here, you're going, well, I don't remember, you know, when I read about what the prince's staff was doing when they first came here, it doesn't sound like this. Yeah, remember that's pre-Adam and Eve. Right, pre-Adam and Eve, the prince's staff is doing a lot of the very basic material sorts of things, getting a little bit of primitive religious, revelatory religion going and some things like that. But, you know, it's pretty practical sort of stuff, though, and, you know, relating to domestication of animals and, you know, a lot of stuff like that, right? Sanitation, rudimentary civilizational things. But they're talking about once you have Adam and Eve, then it starts to take on this polarity. Right. So, you know, to see what this interplay is, like I said, why do they keep this polarity? They want, this is the differentiation, the tension that they're setting up between the two headquarters. That interplay between religion and the beginning of philosophy, kind of on the one hand, and science on the other, and very practical things, economics and whatnot.
And they talk about that in the paper we read the other day about the epics, you know, mm-hmm. which go in that sequence in a way. Mm-hmm. You kind of end up like what you were saying.
Right.
And when after Adam and Eve come, they start getting into the latter epics that I guess the prince takes care of.
Yeah, and so when all is said and done, there's this duality. They're giving you the clue right there. If you reflect on the things that they teach in those two schools, what really is the duality that they're sort of literalizing as two headquarters? One headquarters is for the outer life, and the other headquarters is for the inner life. Okay? And isn't it kind of interesting that people who have a bias towards their spiritual consciousness have long been fascinated and fixated on the garden, and, you know, and thinking of the garden as really kind of this place, this sanctum for the inner life, But actually, it's the other way around. It's actually the prince's headquarters that's meant to eventually evolve into being the headquarters for the schools of the inner life. And the garden, the gardens are gardens. The gardens are in the outer life. It's sort of a duh when you think about it, right? I mean, that's, you know, the very environment of the place speaks of the outer life, right? But if you blur material and spiritual together, pretty material becomes spiritual to you. Gardens are pretty. They're spiritual. About, you know, the inner life, it's like, no, you're totally, you got it totally mixed up, right? See, that's you know, that fixation on the garden, see, is just like the apostles. Jesus tried to get him to separate matter and spirit, and he couldn't do it. And we still can't do it. We're still blurring them together. You know, and we're none of us have found spirit because we've contented ourselves with fancy matter being spirit. Fancy arrangements of molecules, you know, pretty gardens, quote unquote, is spiritual. It's like, no, it's just material. It's not spiritual at all. Right?
Isn't that just Maslow's hierarchy in practice?
I mean, you can right, yeah. You can see how there's a lot of these ideas that humans have kind of been dancing around but haven't quite brought into clear focus exactly what's going on. And Revelation is trying to get you to finally stop sort of playing around the edges, you know, but to really definitively get a hold of of the physics of things, you know, the nature of things. Remember, the word physics just means nature. When I use that word like that, I'm talking about the fundamental nature of things, the physics of things. I mean, to really see it clearly, get things separated so that you don't have this blurring together.
However,
yeah?
A nice natural nature situation is conducive to spiritual.
It's a favorable condition,
right? Mm-hmm.
For perhaps, you know, getting more attuned to the subtleties of the spiritual inputs into your mind, yes. Right? I mean, if the material thing is in chaos, it's hard to have the peace of mind.
Well, they talk about that, religious things could be if you can have them rather than indoors and stuff.
Right.
Like that.
If the material environment is screaming, you're not going to hear the still small spiritual voice. Okay. Obviously, right? I mean, that's obvious. Okay. But it's just, you don't be careful not to keep them separated still.
Right?
Right? That's the trick. To not let them blur together. Okay, so just so that's a fun little tidbit that you may not have ever sunk in, because it's only in this paragraph that they give you that, where you can reflect on it. It's like, wait a minute, I see what twofold this is. This is inner life, outer life. And try to recognize the pattern that they are fostering. Okay.
The continuing existence of the planetary Adam and Eve, together with the pure line nucleus of the violet race, imparts that stability of growth to Edenic culture by virtue of which it comes to act upon the civilization of a world with the compelling force of tradition. In these immortal material sons and daughters, we encounter the last and the indispensable link connecting God with man, bridging the almost infinite gulf between the eternal creator and the lowest finite personalities of time. Here is a being of high origin who is physical, material, even a sex creature like your Urantia mortals, one who can see and comprehend the invisible planetary prince and interpret him to the mortal creatures of the realm. For the material sons and daughters are able to see all the lower orders of spiritual beings. They visualize the planetary prince and his entire staff, visible and invisible.
And just kind of notice it's spirit beings. A fun thing to start really reflecting on, just a little side, is when they say spiritual and when they say spirit.
Spirit.
Yeah. Remember, if they don't put the AL suffix on there, they want you to think more directly. Right?
Beings made of spirit substance.
Yeah. Well, it's just, they're speaking, okay, directly, that there's some spirit energy there, literally, right? It's not spirit-like. right? Spiritual, okay, it's literally spirit. Now, the caveat to that is, you know, that AL suffix doesn't just mean like. It also could mean of, right? It could just be very straightforward, meaning of spirit. Right? So sometimes the word spiritual is, you know, used as saying of spirit, you know, so it's more direct. Other times it's indirect. You got to figure out in context, okay? But if they want to avoid that potential confusion, you know, you see the word spiritual, you go, well, okay, is it of spirit or like spirit here? Which way am I supposed to interpret it? If they're worried that you could, select the wrong one, the incorrect one, and they don't want you to do that, they will literally just say spirit then, instead of saying spiritual, and avoid the potential confusion. Okay? You know, so if they want you to think spirit consciousness and not spirit-like consciousness, they'll say spirit consciousness instead of spiritual consciousness. Okay, just little details like that. Anyway, back to the immediacy here. One little thing, we wondered about this. There seemed to be a little clue here. That first sentence, so you got Adam and Eve going on, together with the pure line nucleus of the violet rays. You know, the thing they never explain is exactly how long Adam and Eve themselves keep procreating. Remember, we were talking about that. And how long there continues to be a pure line nucleus. You get the sense that, you know, that there is some degree of extended, you know, ongoingness of that pure line nucleus, but we don't really know how long they maintain that. I mean, maybe, you know, you think logically, well, maybe you have to always have a pure line nucleus until you finally have the races all blended together into one race and fully uplifted. I mean, what would be the point of an ongoing pure line nucleus after that? You know, so maybe it just goes on and, you know, say for the sort of the 25,000 years or whatever it takes them to get everyone into a one race and upstepped. But anyway, it isn't the case that, you know, they just reproduce, you know, themselves for a short time, you know, and, you know, maybe have, you know, 100 kids or something, and then it just goes into the descendants. It obviously they are continuing to maintain that core for an extended period of time here. The whole indispensable link, we kind of appreciate that.
Can you talk about the compelling force of new tradition up there?
Oh, yeah. That's, I knew there was something else I wanted to bring in. Yeah, thank you. Right, so that, you know, that whole bit.
We don't have much of.
Right, we have, you know, just like that, it is a custom which eventually spreads. Right, again, that, like I said, the impact of that long established line we were talking about before, right? That, you know, the longer the legacy, you know, legacy from the past becomes tradition in the present, and they're speaking to that. So, you know, the more you've got this uniform legacy, the more weight the tradition has in the present. And that's what they were speaking to in that bit about 37,000 years, 500,000 years.
Right.
I mean, the power of the tradition influence in the present because of that long, consistent legacy.
Society today seems to be anti-tradition.
In
my lifetime.
Yes, exactly. See, that's, we got enough spiritual consciousness that we could recognize the limitations of our mores, you know, the legacies become traditions, you know, establish our mores, you know, and the conventions from those traditions that we try to carry forward in time. You know, we got normally on a normal world, everyone kind of stays down in the ignorant flow of things. We got a little bit more, you know, we got some recognition of ideals kind of ahead of ourselves, this greater spiritual consciousness where we go, well, this is less than I can imagine. On a normal world, no one can really imagine better than the present that they live in, okay? But we can very easily go, you know, way outstrip that. And the tension built and built, and so finally, like you're saying, it broke kind of in the middle of the 20th century, where we finally decided that that all of our traditions were just wholly wanting, and we whole scale threw them out.
Maybe with the bathwater.
Okay, so how is it going to go for us if we try to be liquid with no vessel to pour ourselves into? Right. What's going to happen to civilization? Right? That's the emergency. Right? See, another way to think about the emergency.
We're watching it.
Right? We have this like, well, I can imagine it better being this, so let's just throw all this stuff out. Okay, yeah, but you need to replace it with something. No, we can just live free form. No, you can't. Right? A glass of water has to be in a glass. Right? Especially when you think about fundamentally, you're a mindful self. And that's more liquid-like than solid-like, right? You have to pour that mindful self into a framework, into a solid mori system. If you don't have some kind of a mori system, you'll have chaos, right? And mori systems can't be established by fiat. They're an evolutionary phenomenon, as the revelators try to teach us, you know, when they talk about mores. Right? But we got this Luciferian thought in our head that whole evolutionary process over millennia that had produced the mori system that we had in the middle of the 20th century was devoid of any value. There's no value in an evolutionary process. Let's just throw it all out, and we're just going to go free form, or if we have some structure, we're just going to impose it out of our imagination. No. You're not the whole, right? There's no way. And so that's why everything is falling apart. The families are all falling apart. You know, all of our institutions are falling apart because there's no mori system for them to be in. There's no framework. You'll have chaos, anarchy, collapse of civilization. You know, we have to, again, be patient. It's like, yes, but this mori system is so limited. I mean, I can imagine something much more idyllic. Yeah. And you'll get there through a long evolutionary process.
And we want it today.
And I want it now. I want the future. I want light and life now. No, light and life is who knows how many thousands of years in the future. It could be hundreds of thousands of years in the future yet. Right? Who knows? So, again, this impatience. All right. These are the great lessons, you know, that the stories of the prince and his staff and Adam and Eve teach us. Like I tried to, you know, when we're back on those developmental epics, you know, I tried to stress that. That's the big lesson. They failed because they didn't trust the evolutionary process. They didn't have the insight to see its value. All they could see is on the surface what it wasn't, rather than what it is, right? And
so at what point are we
in the same point,
the evolutionary, the process? Because we are,
I mean,
you know, we as a culture, we as a people, you know, as we whatever, we actually are out, you know, out working out the evolutionary process, and the, as a result of what we do, in a way. Mm-hmm. So we are that evolutionary process versus, you know, being like Adam and Eve, who were trained and so on and so forth, knew a whole lot better.
Yeah.
You know, maybe we can read this and say we do it a whole lot better, but
yeah,
we are the people who evolutionarily move us forward, so to speak, one way or another, you know, one step at a time.
But the trick here, right, but the trick is recognizing where you are and what the job at hand is. You're not in the age of spiritual striving. You live in the material comfort era.
Right.
It's like, well, I don't want to live in the material comfort era because that's dominated by greed and gluttony and tyranny and, you know. Yes, but that's the age you live in. And you say, well, yeah, but there's no value in that age. No. Really? If there was no value in that age, it wouldn't exist.
They take that act. You have to act. They take that too seriously.
Your job is to actualize the potentials of the material comfort era. Your job is not to actualize the potentials of the age of spiritual striving.
What is that?
Make better wine? Is that
right?
Where what is that quote, and how would you tie it into what you're saying?
No,
that, that we act, that you must... You know the one I mean.
I mean, religionists may act, may not always act wisely. They may even act irreligiously, but they act.
But they act.
Right,
yeah.
That quote, yes.
Yeah.
Right, I mean, you definitely are supposed to act, but, you know, remember that the big problem is not that there aren't people acting. The problem right now is that people are acting unwisely.
Right.
Right? And no amount of, you know, say, spiritual consciousness or even, you know, the religious impulse or even rudimentary religious consciousness has any wisdom in it. Okay, but people don't believe that. They believe that their spiritual consciousness is innately divine, that it's innately wise. No, it's not. Right, so they think they can just act, and it's automatically wise because they're spiritual. Right? No. That's the problem. And that was okay for the religionists to be acting unwisely when we all lived in the sheltered bay. Well, we don't live in the sheltered bay anymore. The Supreme pushed us out. And it's, you can't act unwisely out on the high seas because you flounder and sink. Right? We're not in the Blue Lagoon anymore. You know? Well, there's this beautiful white sand, and you know, and you can see the, you know, the bottom of the 3-foot deep, you know, warm waters that you're bathing in. No, we're not there anymore. Right? The water seems to have no bottom, and it's pitch black, and it's tossing and turning. That's where we are now, out on the high seas. Okay, so then just one other little thing in passing. Remember, they talked earlier about at the beginning of the paper about the physics of the physical nature of Adam and Eve's material sons and daughters. You know, they're reminding you of why they called them semi-material rather than material back when they, you know, when they used that designation. I mean, obviously they can't be merely material if they're able to see all the lower orders of spirit beings. Right? Just a little reminder that, you know, and the very fact that all the lower orders, so it's like, well, that's a significant nature that they have. Maybe saying semi-material is kind of appropriate. They're sort of like half material, half not so much, right? Half a little more than material.
If they were magic, they could see with material eyes.
Right. That's why I said physics. Right. Right. They're reminding you of the physics of these beings. Okay.
With the passing of centuries through the amalgamation of their progeny with the races of men, this same material son and daughter become accepted as the common ancestors of mankind, the common parents of the now blended descendants of the evolutionary races. It is intended that mortals who start out from an inhabited world have the experience of recognizing 7 fathers. 1, the biological father, the father in the flesh. 2, the father of the realm, the planetary Adam. 3, the father of the spheres, the system sovereign. 4, the most high father, the constellation father. 5, the universal father, the creator son and supreme ruler of the local creations. 6, the super fathers, the ancients of days who govern the super universe. 7, the spirit or Havona father, the universal father, who dwells on paradise and bestows his spirit to live and work in the minds of the lowly creatures who inhabit the universe of universes.
Okay. This is a great opportunity, you know, to feel like you only have half the story. Right? If, you know, as I've been talking for, on and on and on for papers and papers and papers, we often bring up the word mother. You know, and especially in this immediate context where we have Adam and Eve, that should, you know, bring this to the fore for you. I mean, it's like, well, what about Eve? I mean, doesn't what they just said beg a question? Right? Right? The other half of the story, again, remember that fundamentally the Urantia book is, in a very direct fashion, is giving you the individuality viewpoint and God the Father, and it's up to you to find the whole of the revelation, and in relation to that whole, that the whole of it, find the mother. Okay, but there are definitely points in the book where, I mean, it's just screaming at you, like, what about the other parent? Okay, I mean, isn't there another parent here? I mean, you have a biologic father, yes, but you also have a biologic mother. That one should scream at you. And then, you know, there's also a mother of the realm, right? There's not just a father of the realm. You know, when you go beyond that, you know, it's not so immediate. But as above, so below. I mean, if there's a biologic mother and a mother of the realm, right, that's a downstepped expression of a higher pattern. So you know there's also the hierarchy of mother that you can begin to recognize. And of course, you know, like we talk about that, if we, you know, the psychic circles in the sevenfold chart, you know, for instance, I put the hierarchy of cosmic mothers on that chart, you know, as a little reminder of the rest of the story, you know, that you can fill out. But just, you know, this is a good spot to just, you know, think about that too. Don't just rationalize the universe with this hierarchy of the fathers. They're very important. Nothing happens without an initiator, without the father. Right. But where's the hierarchy of upholding? We talked about upholding a little bit ago. Right? You've got initiating. You have initiating. What about upholding? What about the other half of the story? Now, the one thing that might strike you, and they'll point that out in a little bit, is why is the planetary prince not in this hierarchy? Why is it Adam that's in this hierarchy rather than the planetary prince? That's kind of an interesting little tidbit to notice. And it goes, you know, it just skips him, goes from Adam up to the system sovereign. Notice also the last part, you know, number 7, the spirit or Havona father. The fact that, you know, that in this hierarchy here, they're really not thinking of the infinite father, you know, that's actually on the aisle. I mean, they refer to that fact, but what they actually give you is the presence within the sevenfold of the Universal Father in Havona. That should get you thinking a little bit too about, they seem to be talking about fathers in domains rather than kind of the infinite father, which you don't really think of being in a domain at all, right? But they're talking about domains here, and that again, he encourages you to think about the mother, you know, who holds that domain, right? Every domain is established and maintained by a mother. Okay, but you can see it's not simple. It's not like you have a separate mother for a local system and a separate mother for a constellation, and so it's the parallel is not simplistic. You know, with the mother hierarchy.
I never thought of the Ancients of Days really as being of a father. You know, having experiencing, recognizing. I mean, I never really thought of that. But
yeah, and it's a complex thing because it's, you know, it's not a super father. It's super fathers. It's the three as one. Yeah, so there's that, you know, it's you know, there's a lot of complexities here, but nonetheless, you know, I mean, maybe one of the ways, I won't go off on that tangent, you know, extensively, but maybe just one little thing you can think about with the super fathers is, remember, they're the capital J judges, you know, and you know, your immediate instinct about which parent is going to judge you would be father would judge you rather than mother, right? So, you know, that maybe can kind of get you in that initial space of appreciating how, you know, they would be functioning, you know, in a father-like role. Another way that you can think about it is if you reflect on when Michael, you know, let go of the reins for his seventh pistol, you know, and things were in the hands of the Ancients of Days and the Most Highs very directly, all right, it was going to be none of this spread out over time, evolutionary parent thing. This is going to be fiat parent mode, right? See, it's a father mode, right? There's, you're not going to let any sort of, you're not going to let a Lanonadec even look cross-eyed, right? It's a very fiat father sort of a phenomenon that's coming down from those Ancients of Days. Yep.
Well, the key too, it's the experience of recognizing seven fathers. Well, it's talking about personal experience. And mm-hmm. The scheme of things, the planetary prince doesn't seem to be a being that we develop a personal relationship to.
Right.
Do we kind of skip over it?
Yeah, right.
But we do have a personal relationship with the system sovereign in a way I don't really mm-hmm. understand.
Yeah. Good point. You're kind of anticipating what's coming up ahead. You know, the fact that the planetary prince is invisible, right? So, experience of recognizing, yeah, it seems to be out of the experiential possibility if they're not tangible, if they're invisible, right? Now, the other thing before we go on is just to appreciate, you know, what you're getting back to, the little preface there, Gene. You know, where it says that it is intended. So in other words, it's very fundamentally, foundationally important, right, that you have the experience of recognizing seven fathers. So if there were issues with your biologic father, okay, the very foundation of this whole hierarchy has been knocked out. And then Adam dropped the ball, so you don't have the first story either. So the ground level and the first story, right, might be knocked out for you. Oops, what about and Lucifer? Oh my goodness gracious, right? See, so, you know, no wonder that we might be a bit off kilter. It might be hard for us to kind of get our footing, to get our sea legs, you know, as it were, when we've got a threefold problem with fatherhood.
We're being raised by mom.
Okay. I mean, fortunately, mom upholds, right? But she's upholding something that didn't get initiated. And it's kind of in stasis, right? Suspended animation. Right? It didn't get the proper initiating that the father influence, you know, would give. So that's certainly food for reflection, and how strong they are that, you know, it is intended that you have. Okay, we should have time to finish it up here, this last section.
7, United Administration. From time to time, the Avonal Sons of Paradise come to the inhabited worlds for judicial actions. But the first Avonal to arrive on a magisterial mission inaugurates the fourth dispensation of an evolutionary world of time and space. On some planets, where this magisterial son is universally accepted, he remains for one age, and thus the planet prospers under the joint rulership of three sons, the planetary prince, the material son, and the magisterial son, the latter two being visible to all the inhabitants of the realm.
Okay, so you see, now it's really starting to sound like they're segueing into the next paper. And you've got that possibility that a magisterial son comes, like they're saying, in a universally accepted mode and stays for the whole age. So that kind of answers a question that you might have had. It's like, well, Do the magisterial sons always kind of do sort of a Jesus-like thing, you know, where they kind of just come for a short, you know, span, and then off they go, you know, and leave things in the hands of the staff, prince's staff, and Adam and Eve? No. I mean, sometimes, you know, they stay the whole time. And like they say at the end there, remember that first magisterial mission, the magisterial son and his 12 Melchizedek assistants are all in corporeal form, right? So, you've got a visit. You have not only Adam and Eve tangible, but you've got the magisterial son tangible, as well as a ruler for maybe long span of time, thousands and thousands and thousands of years. And, yeah. Yep. Did you have something?
Oh, I'm just thinking of the twelve Melchizedek, and Jesus had the 12. Human apostles.
Yeah, the contrast. Yeah. Jesus had 12, relatively ignorant fishermen. Yeah, and a magisterial son has 12 Melchizedeks. Yes. Does everyone remember? Was anyone confused at the beginning there? You remember about how avonals, or magisterial sons, don't just do magisterial missions. You remember that? How there's three different things they do. Normally they do the bestowal son mission as well, except when the creator son does, on one planet in his local universe. And then there's those quote-unquote judicial actions that the avonals or the magisterial sons do. Remember, every dispensation is inaugurated by a magisterial son coming in, invisible spirit form, and overseeing the whole rigmarole, right? You got archangels and and whatnot going on with these transitions from one dispensation to the next. But the whole complexity is overseen by an avonal son, a magisterial son, on a judicial action, quote unquote. Yeah.
Yeah. Excuse my ignorance, but what, for an age, what is an age? Is this a dispensational?
Yeah, that's what they're meaning by that, for the whole dispensational age. Yeah, yeah.
That could be thousands.
Right, that they would at least stay around until sometimes there's multiple magisterial sons before a bestowal son. Okay, so they would at least stay around until the next magisterial son, but maybe there's only one magisterial mission. Right, and so they would be around until the bestowal son comes.
Right? Excuse my ignorance, yep. But what is the third dispensation?
Okay, yeah. So I thought there might be confusion with that. Right. So you've got the pre-planetary prince. That's the first dispensation. Right? Then post-planetary prince is two. Post-Adam and Eve is three. Post-magisterial son is four. Now, and if you need a little reminder, look to the next page. Look at the beginning of the next paper, and it's got the list there. See, the post-magisterial son man is four. Okay. Yeah, the thing that everyone forgets about is there's that dispensation prior to the planetary prince coming. Yeah. Now, on a normal world, that's a relatively short span of time. But on ours, it was 500,000 years. That was a full-on dispensational sort of a thing, right? Yeah. So that's what they're referring to there. Let's see. The fascinating thing is just the between the lines of universally accepted, quote unquote. Obviously there's kind of shades of Michael's experience here, right? I mean, may not end in, being crucified or something, but they're reminding you that the evolutionary process varies from world to world. It can be very complicated. Some processes are short and some are long, and some are simple and some are complicated. And so there's some, even when there's no rebellion, no default, nothing like that, there's a full planetary prince and his staff and an Adam and Eve and everything is going smoothly, the world is not coming together very rapidly. And so the magisterial son doesn't hang around for a long period of time, because all good things taken to extreme become bad, right? If
like on the other worlds of rebellion, like on the neighboring planet, They're waiting for him to show up. He made
right.
Show up. Be
right. Now that, yeah, I mean, that's an extreme example. I was going to get to that in just a second. Yeah, right. Yeah, exactly. But see, I was trying to point out, I mean, it's obvious as the way they're talking about it. It's, you know, doesn't mean it's only in, you know, complicated situations like the neighboring planet. And you can just imagine that there might be this long kind of convoluted process for Adam and Eve on that world to kind of bring things together. And there's some real sharp tensions, some divisions on the world that that a group of people that have potential in the long term, but they're reacting too negatively to this sort of fiat influence of a magisterial son just plopping himself in their midst and, you know, kind of making demands upon them that they're not ready to assume. You know, and so apparently at times, you know, the wise thing is to stay a relatively short period of time and then trust the Supreme and let it play out over time. So that's why I wanted to bring that up. It just wraps back around to this thing I keep coming back to tonight, you know, to trust in the process of evolution. And even a magisterial son is going to have to bow to the Supreme sometimes. You know, he's not the be-all, end-all. You know, even though he came from the Isle of Paradise, right? The Supreme outranks him, right, in the evolutionary domain. And so sometimes they step out and just let the process play out over a long span of time. Let's see, anything else in there? I think that's, you know, that does it. Notice that at the beginning of it, but the first Avonal to arrive on a magisterial mission, see, they're reminding you there might be multiple magisterial missions there. All right, let's get some more here.
Before the first magisterial son concludes his mission on a normal evolutionary world, there has been effected the union of the educational and administrative work of the planetary prince and the material son. This amalgamation of the dual supervision of a planet brings into existence a new and effective order of world administration. Upon the retirement of the magisterial son, the planetary Adam assumes the outward direction of the sphere. The material son and daughter thus act jointly as planetary administrators until the settling of the world in the era of light and life, whereupon the planetary prince is elevated to the position of planetary sovereign. During this age of advanced evolution, Adam and Eve become what might be called joint prime ministers of the glorified realm.
Okay, kind of get the analogy there. Just two little things to kind of bring out. The first was, I didn't finish responding to your thought about the neighboring planet, because I wanted to wait until we read this sentence here. Okay, before the first magisterial son concludes his mission on a normal evolutionary world. So you can see that they're kind of speaking in that normal mode, but we can think about the abnormal, you know, sort of a world here. Right, you can imagine on the neighboring planet where you also had a rebellion and a default. I mean, they desperately need that magisterial son, as they say at the end of that paper about the neighboring planet. They're like, please, please come soon, please, please. Right, you know, they don't have the spirit of truth. They don't have the universal bestowal of thought adjusters. They've got a tenuous little group of people with a little bit of biologic uplift that are trying to hang on by their fingernails. Right, they really need the magisterial son there. But you can imagine that, you know, there may be complexities. I mean, it's like, well, on the one hand, you could argue they don't have a planetary prince or an Adam and Eve. Shouldn't he stay for a long time and try to substitute for them a little bit? Well, yes, maybe. But maybe he just should stay long enough to kind of get something solidified you know, and then leave and let it play out more in an evolutionary fashion. But there's also, if he actually kind of gets things stabilized a little bit better, you might have, you know, a replacement planetary prince sent. Right? You know, so maybe one of the tasks he would have is, you know, is kind of getting the favorable conditions so that, you know, you could, because you can't just plop a planetary prince into total chaos either, right? So, yeah, all those complexities, you know, would be in play that you can speculate on about how long one of these magisterial suns might remain, even on an abnormal world. You know, how long, you know, let's say 200 years from now we get a magisterial sun. You know, how long would he remain?
I don't know. Creator sun didn't last very long.
Right? I mean,
I got rid of him quick.
Now, you know, the thing to remember about is, you know, there's shades of, you know, if Mike, if Mach Aventa Melchizedek, you know, decides tomorrow to set up a planetary headquarters, you know, with a visible staff and everything. I mean,
the master physicist, visible or invisible?
A visible staff.
Oh, okay.
Right, I mean, he has to have a staff to interact with us. That's the whole point of having a planetary prince. Otherwise, it's, you know, how is it going to be really different than having a resident governor general and stuff, right? Yeah. Right. So, you know, I mean, if he decides tomorrow to do that, okay, the master physical controllers are going to prevent us from destroying that. I mean, we could launch nuclear weapons at the thing, but they'll just, you know, turn them off, evaporate them. Right. So, I mean, you know, there's those issues, and would that be too disruptive? I mean, you know, why hasn't Mach Aventa set himself up as planetary prince yet? Right? He's, I mean, he's obviously weighing all these things. There's positives and negatives to coming now or later. In some ways, we need him desperately right now. Other ways, that may be too much of a cultural shock right now. Right? Be too disruptive.
The hour has not come.
Right? I mean, obviously, I mean, the answer must be it's still too disruptive, or he'd be here already.
Yeah.
Right? But anyway, I mean, so my point was that, you know, a magisterial son certainly could, you know, if it's appropriate, he could get protection from the powers that be, you know, and not be subject to the whims of, you know, someone wanting to send him to the happy hunting grounds, you know. You know, so, you know, remember, Jesus could have done that too, but he decided not just to let it play out. He didn't even need help. He could have just done it himself, right? Right. So, you know, you don't have to assume that they're subject to primitives chopping their heads off, right? Let's see. Anything else there? See, there was two things I wanted to say. Did I say them both? I can't remember here. We get so far off track, I can't remember what we're doing here. The normal thing, right? And then, there was one other thing, right. Following up on Gene's thought about the hierarchy of fathers. See right there where it says, upon the retirement of the magisterial son, the planetary atom assumes the outward direction of the sphere. Right, see, that's in that why he's the father of the realm. You know, we kind of recognize that the invisible one, right, can't assume the outward direction. He says that's fundamentally why. It's just because he's tangible, he's visible, he puts a face on the planetary, you know, leadership. You know, so he's the quote unquote father of the realm.
Was the planetary sovereign become visible, or
no? Planetary sovereign is still invisible
until we.
But of course, remember, yeah, when we get deep in, you know, light and life and stuff, they've modified us, and the master physical controllers are modifying the environment so we can see all the lower spiritual beings too. So eventually, mortals on this world will see the planetary sovereign. But
without Adam and Eve, it takes over here.
Right. Okay. I mean, for those of you on the webinar, saying, "Well, what without an Adam and Eve? You know, how does this work? How, you know, how can there be an outward direction?" Well, remember, if Mach Aventa sets up as planetary prince, he's going to have a corporeal staff. Right. He's going to have a tangible staff. When the magisterial son comes, right, he's corporeal, and so are his 12 Melchizedeks. Right. So you've got all of them, and some of the more kind of, you know, functional influences of the Adam and Eve, that's like I always point out. Remember, a lot of the revelators speculate that Mach Event won't just assume planetary sprints, but material sun, not biologically, but you know, he will take over that role of shepherding the biologic issues, helping us with genetics and genetic engineering and eugenics and all those issues. And if not him, it's got to be someone, right? Some revelators speculate, well, maybe some of the Adam and Eve's children on Adentia will come and take, you know, there's all these different speculations. Right? But someone has to, someone tangible has got to get in with us and, you know, help us with the biologic issues. Yeah.
I can't help but think that, well, God helps those who help themselves. You know?
Right.
If we're, drowning, help, please.
Right.
You know, we're not going to get the help we may think we need. Mm-hmm. It's only because the help, if when it comes, is going to demand a lot from us.
Right, yeah.
And that's, we have to be, we have to have a mature desire for the help, I think,
before, yeah,
be forthcoming.
What does it matter to a true son?
Right, I mean, again, right, the separation between, right, there's the individual issues, all earthly things can crash, right, and you're fine as an individual. But then there's the, you know, there's the planetary issues, separate from our individual issues, you know, and that's mostly what we're focusing on right here. I mean, this doesn't really have much to do with, you know, your salvation and that sort of stuff, right?
But however, yeah, throughout history, you know, they've talked about the fact that, you know, oftentimes we've taken, you know, one step forward, two steps backwards, or vice versa. So doesn't, you know, the progression, if it's all part of evolution, you know, and we don't march in the time right along with evolution, we do go backward for a while, and then we'll have to, you know,
right,
move forward. Right. I mean, hopefully, you know, we don't really hope, we would want that to happen, but
right,
it that, will still progress eventually.
Right, it still would. Yeah, but that was the point I was making a while back. Remember, if you don't want it to end up going one step forward and two steps back, right? You need to know what age you're ministering in. If you try to minister imagining you live in the age of spiritual striving, it will go one step forward and 10 steps back. Right, that'll be the next interregnum, like they tell you, right? But if you face facts, you live in the material comfort era, and adjust them to ideals, right? We can actually take one step forward and no steps back. It won't be a huge step forward, but it will be a lasting step forward. You know, which do you prefer, a lasting little step forward or a great big step forward that doesn't last for more than 10 minutes and we fall back 10 steps? You know, it's your choice. Which do you want?
As evidence, speaking of just what you're saying, mm-hmm, as evidence by, you know, for a short period of time, sometime in the, I guess, the 90s, when the world was more economically sound and people were doing better, you know, when people have that security thing going for them, they seem to progress. You know, there's not, as opposed to when there's no jobs and there's no economic benefits and things are going backwards, that's when things seem to get chaotic. Mm-hmm. So if you're able to have a well-run, secure age, mm-hmm, then maybe you're able to move that needle a little bit into the educational age, which I think is next or something along
that line. You just need to be very patient. Just, you know,
but you can see it works.
Again, remember, it's a tadpole thing again, right? I mean, don't try to take a great big frog leap, right? Right, just wiggle the tail a little bit and go forward a little bit as a tadpole. That will be stable if we do that. You know,
and that's what we want to try to do. Still have, you know, good personal relationship with God and religious thing in the material age.
Right. So again, like I was saying, you keep the collective and the individual things separate. Right. I mean, even though the planet might only take one little baby step forward, you could take huge steps forward as an individual. But don't imagine that just because you take huge steps forward as an individual, that you're going to just, you know, it's going to redound to the whole, right? No. Right. You're not a magical being.
It doesn't even redound to your kids.
Right.
Looks like you're going here.
Yeah, let's see. We finished that up, didn't we?
As soon as the new and consolidated capital of the evolving world has become well-established, And just as fast as competent subordinate administrators can be properly trained, subcapitals are founded on remote land bodies and among the different peoples. Before the arrival of another dispensational son, some 50 to 100 of these subcontinents will have been organized. Subcenters, excuse me.
Okay, you know, just the between the lines I kind of referred to. I mean, obviously there was a much more immediate plan on this world to produce these subcapitals, this subcapital sort of subcenter phenomenon, as opposed to just one. You know, we didn't have the option of having two because of the rebellion. So
remote land bodies, why are they on remote?
Well, I mean, you know, if there are.
This just means far away.
Right, yeah, yeah.
Not remote islands.
You mentioned that with our plan, you know, that a million Pure Line were going to go over, you know, to North and South America, right? Right, that sort of phenomenon where you.
I gotcha.
You can't, you know, it's fundamentally a world where you can't just kind of have one center and it just oozes out, you know, everywhere. You can imagine some worlds might have kind of just sort of one sort of continent sort of a thing. It might not be so broken up and stuff, you know, and so it might be easier to kind of just spread it out from one center. And then other planets that might be really, you know, spread out into kind of just big islands all over the planet or something. It could be, you know, all kinds of different possibilities. So, but obviously the fact that all the races kind of went off to the four corners on this planet and everything, even though it isn't as intensely geographically disrupted as you could imagine, racially it was very broken, fragmented, and so that, you know, you can see why they would be thinking more in terms of the subcenter rather than one center sort of mode here. All right. Let's see, anything else there? The one little thing. Just as fast as competent subordinate administrators can be properly trained. Again, right? Patience, anything there, right? They're pushing it, but they're not over-pushing it, just as fast, and no faster, right? Then the evolutionary process, the whole thing produces competent, right, administrators. So just, again, thinking about that. You know, we can imagine all kinds of idyllic governmental forms right now, but do we have the competent administrators to maintain those idyllic governmental forms that you can imagine? No, we don't even remotely yet. Right? We have to wait for those competent people to evolve before you can have those systems that you can imagine. You got to stick with what we've got right now. Face facts and adjust them to ideals so that you act wisely. Don't ignore the facts. All right?
The planetary prince and his staff still foster the spiritual and philosophic domains of activity. Adam and Eve pay particular attention to the physical, scientific, and economic status of the realm. Both groups equally devote their energies to the promotion of the arts, social relations, and intellectual achievements.
So as they come together more in one, you know, rather than two, they don't totally blur that differential. They still keep the inner life, outer life thing there a bit. But there's overlap stuff, see, like they point out there. So just giving you a little hints on how that, you know, and eventually, of course, we know when they talk about worlds, you know, well-settled and light in life, you know, it evolves away. You don't even have religion and science anymore, right? You have what we would call super philosophy, right? I mean, those science and religion become just totally incorporated into one triune structure that you now call philosophy. And you can kind of even see them indicating that by, they don't say religious and philosophic domains, but they say spiritual and philosophic domains. See, they're even kind of hinting a little bit at that evolutionary process. You know, and the on the Adam and Eve side, the more kind of technology they were talking about before, now they're actually calling science here. Okay. So they're giving you little hints of an evolutionary process there, just the way they word it. All right, let's wrap it up here.
So they still have economics in that time too. That's interesting.
Havona has an economy. Havona. The quote-unquote economy of Havona. right? And that's where you want to remind yourself of what the word economy literally means. The eco is house, and then nomi is laws, the laws of the house, right? We were just talking about that. In the middle of the 20th century, we decided we didn't need laws of the house anymore. We just threw out all the laws of the house. Yeah, how does that work? Even in Havona, there are laws of the house. And remember, those are very, very absolutely maintained. You're not allowed to go into Havona until you can absolutely obey the laws of the house. You're not allowed one tiny little deviation until you can follow the laws of the house absolutely precisely. They don't let you in. Right? You have to have that perfection of purpose, remember, to get into Havona. Right?
Like when you were talking about the vessel and the liquid and that, there was a time we just kind of threw everything.
Let's pour ourselves out on the tabletop and see what happens.
Something solid, right. It's being the law.
Right, yes. I mean, we have this, we'll get to that here very shortly when we get to the Lucifer Rebellion, right? False liberty, right? That's what we're talking about. Thinking that you can have liberty without law. No, liberty has to be in law, just like a liquid has to be in a containing vessel. Right? Liberty in law.
By the time of the inauguration of the fifth dispensation of world affairs, a magnificent administration of planetary activities has been achieved. Mortal existence on such a well-managed sphere is indeed stimulating and profitable. And if your ancients could only observe life on such a planet, they would immediately appreciate the value of those things which their world has lost through embracing evil and participating in rebellion. Presented by a secondary Lanonendek, son of the Reserve Corps.
See, and the fact that byline is just like the previous paper, apparently it's the same secondary Lanonendek, which kind of feels like it with this last section, that the same person wrote this pair of papers, The Planetary Princes and The Planetary Atoms. Just one little thing to stress before we wrap up. Notice what their bottom line is. It's kind of the bottom line we were just talking about with the liberty and law. See, when they say, that if you were to go to one of those worlds, you would immediately appreciate the value of those things. Okay, what things? What did we... The structure, right? Well-managed sphere, right? We don't have the framework, the structure, the economy, the laws of the house, right? And if you don't have that, and then you amp up spiritual consciousness like Michael did 2,000 years ago, so that you have a greater awareness of liberty than we've ever had before, and no law, that's imposed externally upon us, and none of us are choosing to self-impose structure. Right? We have nothing but false liberty. We've joined the rebellion. Unwittingly, we've joined the rebellion. And the battle cry is, you're not the boss of me. I have my rights, etc. We're constantly demanding that we have liberty without law. More and more laws are, they're just kind of suggestions, And we don't need to enforce that law. That law is not very idyllic, so it shouldn't be enforced. All these rationalization schemes that you hear all the time, that's the Lucifer Rebellion. That's the belief that somehow that liberty is self-regulating. No, liberty without law is anarchy. It's the rebellion.
Chaos.
Right. We've unwittingly joined the rebellion, and there's voices of the rebellion everywhere. None of them have read this book. None of them ever even thought about the Lucifer Rebellion, but they preach the principles of it all the time. And it doesn't matter how minor that law might seem, how less than idyllic. No, there has to be structures. You can't just go into a fiat mode where you decide, I don't like this law, so I'm not going to enforce it. Civilization will collapse. You know, and your argument can't be, well, I want, if we're going to have laws, I want them to be the laws of the House of Havona. Well, that doesn't, we're not in the age of light and life. We're in the material comfort era. Right? The laws of the house are going to be relatively primitive. There has to be laws. You know, we can't throw out those laws. So, you know,
just the lawyers.
Just you know, keep that in mind. Keep that in mind when you listen to the political discourse. Not just in this country, but you know, in the whole, you know, Western world. Right? It's the voice of the rebellion. It's liberty without law. Okay, we've got to start singing that again. Right? Thy liberty in law. Right? And remember, it's thy. Right? Where did our liberty come from? It came from God.
How do you do that without a planetary prince, without an Adam and Eve? How do you organize a bunch of apes?
Right, again, see, we're not trying, my job is not to organize the apes. My job is a recognition of personal responsibility. That I have to put myself into conformity with law and to proceed to do that. Self-control.
Oh, I know.
Exercise. It starts with you, right? And if, and notice, see, they're giving you the clue. Is it indeed stimulating and profitable? Okay, so you'll find it stimulating. You'll find it delightful. How much more genuine liberty you have when you put it in law, it will be stimulating, and you'll want to continue that, living in that structure. And you will be successful in your efforts, profitable. Others will see that success, and they'll follow in suit. Right? You don't have to try to figure out some cagey scheme to get them to do this. You just do it. Truth is infectious, right? Live in this truth that you will have a more profitable life if you have liberty and law, and others will try it. Right? But, you know, it's just this free-for-all that's destroying civilization right now. And someone's got to start. It can't start with the collective. It's got to start with one individual. And then two individuals, and then three. You know, you be one of the first. Be a first adopter of truth on your benighted sphere. Someone's got to start living, you know, in truth again. Yeah, and your animal origin nature doesn't like that thought. It's going to rebel against that. You know, you can't make me, you can't make me, is what the lower domain of your hourglass is going to be screaming at you. You've got to take a hold of it and say no. Right? You've got, the upper domain is the parent, the child in the lower domain. Yeah. You've got to take a hold of yourself. Someone's got to start. No, don't underestimate the mustard seed phenomenon. If a few people do it, it's a contagion. It'll spread. You won't have to try to spread it. It'll spread naturally. Right? But someone's got to start. That's what this book is here for. You know, not for the whole planet. It's for the handful of people who can recognize that and be that handful that starts. Right? There's never been more than 1% in the history of the planet of leaders. It doesn't take many. It's a mustard seed phenomenon. You don't have to be a civil leader, right, or something, right? It's, you know, be a leader in the sense of your exhibition of loyalty, right? You will be you'll naturally lead others like that. You know, Jesus didn't try to lead others, right? I mean, they talk about that. He naturally led others because of just the way he lived his life. You know, the religious life of Jesus and how he lived it. All right. Okay, so then we'll get into the planetary epics next time. And you can see just how much it came up in just these two precursor paragraphs. The planetary epics is going to be a lot like those developmental epics. We're going to be constantly wanting to talk about the truth that's flowing through this. You know, how it's trying to teach us what's the problem on our planet right now. You know, we need to appreciate this origin, history, destiny sequence that we exist in, so that we can strike step with it properly again, instead of, you know, thinking we can fiat will our way out of that, you know, the Father's way.
We are now truly an experimental.
Right. And we have to have the courage to be an experimental planet. We've got to have the courage to try and fail. Right? You can't say, well, we're not going to try anything until we can convince ourselves that it won't fail. Well, then you'll never do anything. Right? Okay. Anyway, so yeah, you know, we'll be getting into this conversation a lot. All right, let's take a moment.